Hey guys, what's going on? Welcome to Cinepile Podcast, the podcast that discusses films that matter. And this is episode number 19. We're going to be discussing The Beguiled. But before we get any further with that amazing movie, we're going to first talk about how our friend Kyle out in Prague took a little bit of a field trip. Where'd he go, Neil?
He's going to talk much more about it than I can, yeah. But sounds like you went to Camera Image in Poland. Kyle, what is that?
So Camera Image, I had heard about it last year, I believe it was, when Lion won they win the Golden Frog, I believe it is, for best cinematography at the Camera Image Festival. It takes place in this little tiny town. I guess it's like a small city in northern Poland called Bydgoszcz, which is just all vowels. It's got like an O in there somewhere. But it's like C-Z-G. I don't even know. I had no idea how to say it till I got there. And it's a cinematography festival. So in their opera house, which the town was pretty cool. I could go on about that. It was like medieval. They were surrounded by rivers that served as protection back in the day. And yeah, in their little opera house on the second floor was just every lens and camera manufacturer imaginable. Yeah, just like all these gorgeous anamorphics sitting out.
Anamorphic lenses sitting out?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. Or attached to, like, you know, you can go get your hands on the Arri 65 or the Sony Venice, any of these. You know, it was like the cream of the crop there.
And this is supposed to be like, as far as DPs, like, it's the end all be all, like, super, like, people are coming all over the world, from what I understand, to come to this one particular festival, like Roger Deakins and like the creme de la creme of cinematographers. Yeah.
Yeah, indeed. But that makes it sound like it's this huge media extravaganza. Probably half of the attendees are students, and they actually make a lot of accommodations for students. So if anybody there is interested in studying cinematography, or they are in film school, they have like discounted housing that you can stay in the city to go to the event. And the event itself is dirt cheap. It was all week and it was like $80.
You have to do is fly to Poland.
Yeah.
Or just live close to it.
Yeah, or live close to it like you do now.
Yep. And so for example, in terms of like the creme de la creme, like one of the best workshops I attended was led by Claudio Miranda, who won Best Cinematographer for Life of Pi.
Amazing. Shouldn't have won that year, though.
No, he shouldn't have.
That was the same year as Skyfall, I'm pretty sure.
Yeah, indeed.
Got snubbed pretty hard.
What was pretty incredible, though,
I hold a grudge.
So Claudio Miranda was a really cool guy. I got to talk and hang out with him after the fact. Didn't realize that he was a fairly recent cinematographer. He had actually come up in the industry as a gaffer. And his very first film was Benjamin Button with David Fincher.
That's incredible.
That's not too bad.
That's no. Like a meteoric rise right there.
But so he was already established. I think he'd gaffed a couple of David Fincher's films. And they shot that on an early digital camera. I can't remember which one they said it was, but they really had to work and know what they were doing to get a lot out of that camera. And I would have never guessed that it had the limitations that he talked about, because the film is just beautiful. I don't think the film is maybe that like captivating in terms of I'm not dying to watch it every weekend, you know, but it was a beautiful movie.
Yeah. I just can't get over that he was a gap. That's his first film. That's ridiculous.
You know, I haven't looked at his...
Would you like to do a Hollywood blockbuster as your first DP? Yeah, why not? I mean, I wonder if like he was tight with Fincher and was a previous gaffer and was notable.
Well,
like,
that's what he said. Yeah, he was for sure. He had to have been for sure.
Yeah.
But that's crazy. Yeah. What's the budget? Like, that's got to be like a $100 million budget.
Yeah.
You know, that was something.
Yeah, that was a Christmas movie too. Mm-hmm. So that was a...
Was it?
Yeah. So that was a big, well-to-do kind of Christmas movie and everything. But what would you say, like, just kind of in closing about Camera Image?
Well, there was one other really notable event, and it was actually the Red event, and it was talking a lot about resolution and color, and Christopher Probst, I believe, was his name. He was one of the cinematographers there talking about it, and it seemed like he was just jacked up on crack because he went on like this 15-minute long brilliant rampage of digital imaging knowledge and lens knowledge and his method, and it was incredible. This is the guy who also shot with David Fincher. He shot several episodes of Mindhunter.
Oh, nice.
Okay.
So, and like, you know, these guys are just hanging out there after the event. There are all sorts of screenings I could talk about. Some of them were awful, to be honest, even though they may have looked okay. But what was your question?
I was going to say, did you jot down some notes from that rampage?
Oh, yeah.
I'd be interested in reading those for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which means it's on YouTube or something like that too. Do you know, was it recorded or televised?
Some of them were, like, Ari had a lighting seminar led by, I forget his name right now, but he shot the original Independence Day. Cool. And it was a really nice lighting workshop. He showed the room. He did a morning, an afternoon, and an evening lighting setup. Talked about his method, how it's important to behave on set. There was all sorts of advice. All sorts of like generous pieces of advice from these people who are willing to just share knowledge.
Okay. Well, I guess if anyone's listening right now, I'll go ahead and try to see what we can find as far as juicy YouTube links of the event and provide the information for, I guess, 2018 Camera Image. If you want to buy tickets, I'll have that linked below in the info tab or in the metadata of SoundCloud. And you guys can check that out.
There's got to be an American version of this, right? Like,
I don't know.
That just sounds incredible.
Yeah. Like, so Austin,
for how cheap it is,
yeah,
and how big are these names that are just like sharing valuable information? Like, I don't know. Like, in an industry that's like normally gets a rap of being very closed, you know, like tight to the chest kind of thing, because it's like, oh, it's my livelihood. This is how I.
Yeah, don't want to give away industry secrets.
Yeah, yeah, like that's just awesome.
Yeah,
but I don't want to have to go to Poland to experience that. Not that I don't want to go to Poland. It's just like,
yeah, that's a bit of a hike.
Far.
Yeah.
Well, it was far and it was cold. It was quite cold, but the food, Polish food can be so good.
Decadent. I've never heard that before.
Yeah, I think of like bratwurst and.
You don't like bratwurst?
I mean,
who doesn't?
I go to Wisconsin for that. You know?
Yeah. Was there anything else that you would want to add about Camera Image?
Yeah, well, there was actually one film that really upset me. It was called Voliana, or the American title is Hatred. It was a Polish film, and it was 2.5 hours of torture, literal physical violence. It was takes place during World War II under both German and then Russian occupation. And it's just a series of things getting worse and worse. And
like in Poland?
Yeah, in Poland, in this section of Poland. And at a point later in the film, the Ukrainians, what the film is really about is the Ukrainians took revenge on the Poles for years of mistreatment, which I talked to several Polish people and they were upset that the filmmakers left out a lot of why they were so upset, because it just kind of seems like the Ukrainians all of a sudden just start massacring people. Just like literally they're killing babies on screen.
Oh my God. Oh,
Jesus.
Yeah.
Christ.
Ripping babies out of mothers' bellies, like setting children on fire.
Oh my God.
Decapitating people, tearing their skin off, burning
this
churches.
This is a modern film?
Yeah, it happened. It came out last year and it's all done with like a decent sized budget. Like they tried to make it as real as possible.
Kind of sounds
like, I want to watch it, but I don't want to watch it.
It's like a Serbian movie or Serbian film?
Yeah, we were comparing it to it after we got out of the theater because we were wondering like, what did we just sit through? You know, like, was this violence for the sake of violence? Or what might be the worst option is that maybe it's like a political move. Mm-hmm. Apparently it was funded in part by some sort of Polish government fund.
Isn't there like a right-wing movement in Poland right now?
Yeah, like a big nationalist movement in Poland.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, maybe. Not only Poland, but it's called the Visegrad Group. And so it's Czech, Slovakia, Hungary, and Poland. And all of these countries, just like, I mean, even France, Germany, America right now are seeing this right-wing rise. So it's a film that really bothered me. It was not only on that violence level, but the editing, the decision not to deal with any of the aftermath of the violence. But it's also kind of important in a way, because this is almost like it could be a modern propaganda film. Maybe somebody who knows more about the history could speak to that and tell me one way or another that this is propaganda or not. But it seems that way to me.
Yeah, it's kind of...
Is it streaming on Netflix yet?
Yeah.
No, not yet, but you should... I don't know. Somebody will find a download of it somewhere. Not that we condone any of that activity.
Do you want to talk about the Beguiled here now?
Ah, the Beguiled.
What's to talk about?
Okay. So, I guess first, if anyone hasn't seen the Beguiled, this is a remaking by Sofia Coppola from a 1971 film, also aptly named The Beguiled. And essentially it's about a Union soldier who is found wounded just outside of a Southern school, a proper woman's school, like a boarding school.
It's in Virginia.
Yeah, in Virginia. And
just outside of a battle.
Yeah, and essentially Colin Farrell is playing this Union soldier who's deserted the Union Army and gets found by these women.
Wounded.
And they take care of him. And all the characters start intermingling and chaos kind of starts to ensue. And it's very interesting film to watch for sure. Was that a good synopsis?
Yeah.
Wrap it all up tightly?
Yeah. One little change though is that I read that Sofia Coppola emphasized this wasn't a remake of the 1971 film, but a reinterpretation of the novel.
Right.
So just kind of like True Grit a couple of years ago. It's not a remake of the John Wayne film. It's modern filmmakers going back to the source material.
That's a pretty good distinction. Because not that I haven't watched the original one, which starred Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, we saw a trailer.
Yeah. Yeah, after we watched this modern one, I guess I hadn't known that there was a previous one.
I mean, apparently it's a classic, like very well-known and revered film, which
I don't know why.
And critics really came after Sofia Coppola for making this version.
Yeah. Well, I guess what I was going to say, though, is it's a good distinction because Sofia Coppola, I guess in an interview, you were telling me earlier, Cooper, that I guess her interpretation of what her movie is about is very different than what the original film.
Yeah, because the original film was very much so like sex-starved women can't help their hysteria and just falling in love for Clint Eastwood. And
I mean, it's probably a little deeper than that, but yeah. Like there's definitely that undertone.
Yeah, and with the new one with Sofia Coppola's take, it was very much so emotional based. It was very much so kind of like almost trying to just make it about people being people and who these individuals are and how they act as a sounding board against Colin Farrell, who is trying to manipulate them, not out of an indecent way of like wanting to just harm these women, but out of a way of survival so that he doesn't have to return to battle. And I mean, and we see that in the film when he tries to become useful and when he kind of is on the mend and everything, but then his own hubris that this can't backfire kind of realizes. And so that's where you get this fun big flip of like him being into control to out of control. And I think that was something really great, but
probably one of the most regrettable booty calls caught on film.
Oh yeah, lost a leg for it.
Like he regrets it so hard.
Yeah, for sure. Well, and then
it actually was shot on film.
Yeah, and it was shot on 35, And then something that actually stood out to us initially was the aspect ratio. Kind of like, let's just delve into cinematography real quick. And like the aspect ratio was 1.661, which was kind of random, but was actually because the Lesueur, the DP, he's from Europe, and the 1.66, the 1:1.66 ratio is kind of standard within Europe. And also, fun fact was Shane the Western, that was the first film to ever use the 1:1.66 ratio as well, and it's what is the native format of Super 16mm. So I couldn't find like what they were trying to do to make it that particular aspect ratio, but I thought it was still interesting nonetheless.
Well, the last time we saw it and talked about it, if I'm not mistaken, was The Witch.
Oh, they used a 1.66?
Yeah, because it was a little more narrow than 1080, or right. 1920 rather, and... Yeah, I'd read
it's super noticeable at first. Right. Like the opening frame, I was like, whoa, that's weird. Because it's like just some slivers of pillar boxes. It's not even like giant. It's not like 4x3. But then after a while, I don't know. It just becomes part of the image. You know, it's just a little more claustrophobic.
Yeah, and I think they did a very good job. But they've very much so always had the image filled. I mean, when you're talking about the like sprawling south, you know, it was never that, like, it was never just a clean image of the building. It would be like an image of the mansion or school, you know, being invaded by trees, or an image of this being invaded by something else. So no shot was ever really nice and wide open, especially the dinner shots, which I thought were just really well executed as far as just perspective wise. Because any time that I was noticing during the dinner shooting was, it was coverage. But most of it was either from Colin Farrell's perspective or from Kirsten Dunst's perspective of Colin Farrell. It was very rare that I don't think it even ever occurred that the younger girls like Elle Fanning or any of the other younger girls saw on the other side of the table. So it was very much so you were in the seat of Nicole Kidman, Kirsten Dunst, and Colin Farrell, and these observations toward them and their kind of chess moves toward one another, which I thought was really interesting. And then also the lenses, Neil, that you were telling me that they used were very particular as well, like the old school lenses that they used.
Well, there's just an interesting coincidence that... So I wasn't familiar with Petzval lenses. I guess I've never used one. It's a particular lens that kind of changes the bokeh around like the outer part of the frame to kind of be more circular, and so it kind of draws your eye towards the center of the frame. It's almost like this weird like warping vignette of bokeh, and I hadn't heard of that. I guess I don't know why, I just didn't know that lens. But last week my coworker comes in and he's like, oh, I just bought this, it's a lens called a Petzval lens. So it's like this old school lens he bought from the Ukraine. And he was like testing it out. And I was like, oh, that's cool. And now seeing this movie that they used it, they utilized it on their outdoor scenes. There was an interview I read with the DP that was talking about their use of it for the outdoor scenes to try to give this just an interesting, almost portrait kind of look to it.
Yeah, I think portrait would very much so well define the look of so often. Like, it wasn't framed up, so it wasn't like, you know, anything like super symmetrical kind of portrait shooting, but just like how the frame was constantly crowded, that it seemed that it was a film of faces interacting rather than people playing out. Because honestly, I would say that this film would be so well adapted for the stage at the same time, though, because I think it was just so interesting, like the interplay between everybody. But how they did shoot it, they didn't shoot it wide, obviously, like a play, like we saw. You know, they kept it really tight, and I liked how tight they kept it. They kept it cramped. They kept it stifling, almost in a way.
And we're jumping around quite a bit. Yeah, it was really reserved, like the shooting style. It was really
locked off.
Yeah, everything was super locked off.
Yeah, it was like, let's go down a stairwell or anything.
And somewhat, I wouldn't say it wasn't like wide necessarily, but they didn't, there wasn't a lot of like long lenses with like, obvious like distort. I don't know. It was just, it was, everything was super reserved, super portrait. They were letting kind of the story tell itself through the acting. There wasn't a lot of coverage. I don't know.
It was all very welcome in my opinion.
Yeah.
It was very deliberate and restrained. It didn't try to bring attention to itself, but what it did was, to your point, Cooper, I love those little details that it shows, especially during the dinner scenes, where maybe it's only a glance or a little line of dialogue, but it catches it in such a way and from such a perspective that you understand exactly what this means for the dynamic.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then even with the dinner scenes, I was talking about cinematography, so apparently a lot of that was actually lit with candlelight and very dimly supported by, you know, additional diegetic light. And they actually had 2 wicks per candle in order to create a greater level of luminosity.
Really?
At those dinner table scenes. Yeah, I saw a little thing with the DP Lizard, and he was talking about how they did different candle tests and everything like that. And so they'd have these really tall wicks with double wicks in order to create like twice the luminosity. So I thought that was really creative and really crafty.
Mm-hmm.
But because it was very interesting, because they used the dinner table scenes as these moments to show the progression of change. The first dinner table scene that we saw, the camera's floating around everywhere because it's without Colin Farrell being found. And then once Colin Farrell is a part of the narrative, the camera shifts to the other end of the table. And that was the point of interest, because that's where all the women were looking. And then Colin Farrell, you could see where his interests were and where he was looking. And then the film toward the end of the climax with the dinner table, whole bunch of like action and subtlety of emotional expression toward one another, because a lot of it was passing glances because it was very unspoken between the women, and the only dialogue that really occurred was honestly between Colin Farrell and them. There wasn't a lot of interplay between the girls themselves, unless if it was biting at one another because of fighting for Colin Farrell's attention.
Mm-hmm.
And so like it was very much so like Nicole Kidman when she speaks to Kirsten Dunst at that one table, and she's telling her like, hey, you know, you have a very, you know, open blouse, you know, let's not just, you know, leave that as a distraction. And she was like, and the girl raises her shawl, you know, and like Kirsten Dunst like puts that on, and it's a total power play, and like how she like gestures up to her to show that she's the teacher, that she's this mature, you know, adult. And then after that, like, she gets shot a look by Elle Fanning of just being like, boom, like you're being judged and I'm not, like I'm better. And it's these very like, that's, you know, emotional gameplay that's shown through physical expression, which I think takes a very good director and cinematographer to capture and to shoot and edit and organize to allow that story to play of unspoken words that always happened.
It's interesting. I think one of my favorite parts is just how like, it's such a modern story that like it, that everyone is very austere, right? The time period, everyone is very reserved and like proper.
Mm-hmm.
The cinematography is very austere and like it's very minimal and like old school, and there's nothing crazy, there's no jump cuts or anything crazy. The location is super like timely and beautiful.
Yeah.
But underneath it is a story that we all understand of like jealousy and lust, and it's all like bubbling from underneath.
Yeah.
All these other elements, like the setting, even though it's this like prim and proper place, it's being
consumed.
It's being consumed by nature.
Right.
You know,
it's like and you know, all the trees specifically were a really good symbolic touch, to where the trees have fallen over and the roots are exposed, and the gnarled, mature branches are the only branches, are the ones that you see that are constantly invading the frame. And just like how Neil was saying, that it shows that this like this prim and proper is slowly being torn down. And you know, this is year 3 into the Civil War.
Underneath all that properness is really just
savagery.
In a way, savagery. Yeah, like animalistic kind of, or just human.
Yeah,
imperfect people.
Well, and also like Nicole Kidman's character is trying to upkeep this like last bastion of high society of, you know, civility, and it's not going to be maintained anymore because they, I mean, they talked about how all the slaves had escaped and how essentially their way of life is now coming to an end, and so she's trying to like keep this revenant, I guess you could say, this like, you know, dying living creature alive, and the last thing that goes into it that exposes them for who they are is Colin Farrell, and they also in turn expose him for who he truly is, which is an asshole.
I mean, can you blame him though?
No, I mean, like, because at the same time, yeah, I mean, like, because Neil, you had good perspectives on him towards just like he's just trying to survive in so many respects.
Yeah, he literally gets there and they're basically saying that they're going to turn him over to the Confederates, and there's that scene where he's upstairs and the Confederate army's outside and they have an opportunity to turn him in, and you hear like the corporal, whoever it is for the Confederates, being like, yeah, we're taking these guys to prison to die or whatever. So it's like he knows what's at stake. He clearly fled the battle to survive. He himself is not even American. He came off the boat from Ireland, took like $300 to take someone's spot in the war. He really has no skin in the game. All he really cares about is getting out of this alive. So it's like, it's almost hard to blame him for not being brave, like, if you want to call it that, in battle. And he's manipulating these girls and these women, which is, man, I'm super jumping around.
No, that's okay. But we can talk about Colin Farrell and what his motivations are and, like, talk about the characters, too.
Well, another part that I really liked about the film is how different characters had different connections with Colin Farrell. They each kind of embodied a different level of want with him.
Right.
At least, like, there's, there's four characters that really connect with him out of, like, the six girls. You have Nicole Kidman, who connects with him on, like, an adult level. He's kind of the only person that isn't someone that she looks over, that she can... We have several scenes where she has a drink with him.
Yeah, that can bond with him.
Yeah, bonds with him, not in a necessarily sexual way, even though there's a little bit of, like, sexual tension, but it's mostly just, like, oh, thank God there's someone else that's here that's not, like, my child. They're not her children, but you know what I'm saying.
Yeah, it's a partnership in intimacy.
Yeah, she her actual husband kind of alludes that he died in the war, so she's, you know, maybe he reminds her of him or something. I don't know. It's, like, a respect level.
Right.
Then you have...
Kirsten Dunst.
Yeah, Kirsten Dunst's character, who is younger than Nicole Kidman, but she's an older woman, or, like...
I'd say like second oldest, 17, obviously. Or so, like 17, 18.
Yeah, she's a teacher.
Yeah.
And she's like connecting with him on a deeply personal, like, love level. Not completely sexual.
Yeah.
Mostly on a connection, like...
Like a hopeless romantic,
yes, I would say. Yes, romantic level. Her, like, her wants beat. To run away. Her dream is to get away from this place.
Mm-hmm.
He is a foreigner and is obviously super attractive. Like, she's just swept off her feet. You have... Elle Fanning, who is just straight up
embodies
lust.
Yeah,
straight up, just, she's like coming into that age of like really wanting men.
Yeah.
And she wants Colin Farrell in just pure sexual reasons.
Right. And well, and at the same time, like, because a lot of these girls, I mean, where sexuality is so commonly informed by media, you know, they're not really necessarily informed by anything.
Yeah.
And so they're like, you know, I can see Kirsten Dunst's character as like this French, like, teacher that teaches French. She's like this romantic, like, you know, reads novels most likely that are in these like big bombastic, you know, levels of romance.
Mm-hmm.
And the more immature girl, all she knows how to do is leverage her sexuality because that's all she knows what to do. So she doesn't have an idea of love. So all she can really have is an idea of sexual attraction.
Right. And the youngest girl is the fourth one that has a connection with him.
Mushroom girl.
Yeah, the one that finds him is almost more similar to Nicole Kidman's character, where it's like on a just a human level. There's no sexual tension between them. It's almost, she just wants acknowledgement of like,
she wants to be special.
Yeah, of just being special or something. So it's just, it's this interesting little age. Like, we have four different age groups that have four different like connections to him, and he exploits them all knowingly. Like, right. It was very interesting to me.
Yeah. Exploits them knowingly. I'm curious, do you cast judgment on that? I'm a little on the fence.
No, like
about
I said,
whether...
I don't blame him.
Yeah, because he's trying to keep himself alive, and he essentially was just trying to diversify his assets and just being like, well, I could like go all the way with Nicole Kidman or something like that, but if she rejects me, I'm kind of screwed. So, but if this one girl loves me, that's great. And if like he wants these girls to fight for him, and
I think he just knows how to play a mirror.
Yeah,
you know, he can be that mirror for them. He sees what they're
pretty
wanting.
Much so a con man kind of level.
Yeah, but I don't put any negative judgment on it, really. You know, just in the same way that you could or could not put judgment of him fleeing battle, you know, to survive. It's in a similar vein, in my opinion. Not necessarily like the, what's the word? Like, not manly, but like civil thing or like the correct thing to do, but in the circumstance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not his war, it's not his game. He just wants to.
But even
survive.
If it was, you know, I still wouldn't necessarily fault someone for running from battle. It may not
that's
be the honorable thing, but it's
honorable.
How much
that's
is honor worth if you're dead?
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for.
Honor. Oh, boy. I saw that you ran away from my battle. Well, and then one interesting character. So while we're talking about characters, one interesting character that was omitted from this was actually there was one slave in the original Beguiled that was omitted from this, and Sofia Coppola got a lot of heat about that because they were like, well, why'd you, like, you know, because everyone was just like, oh, so you just like think that you're just like this white director and you don't need to, you're just trying to like whitewash everything and everything like that. And she actually had a pretty great response, the fact that she just didn't feel like you could handle this film and also wrestle with the ideas of slavery and that those are two wholly separate chunks, that to do 50% or half-ass any one of them is a disservice to the other one. And so a lot of critics came after her in a big way, which they kind of have always really come after Sofia Coppola for any of her films, because she's, you know, Francis Ford Coppola's daughter and a person of privilege. And so they came after a lot with excluding the one black character from the entire film, and I wasn't sure.
Yeah, I don't really know if it wasn't about, I don't know, this film wasn't about race at all. It wasn't really about the war at all. You could have added that, but it would be a different film. I don't know.
Yeah, I actually really liked that it was, I don't want to say it's a superficial setting. I really felt the setting through the sound design and the claustrophobic framing. I love the points that y'all brought up about the encroachment of nature. And you could read into that symbolism in terms of the Civil War, but you could also transplant this to numerous other conflicts.
Mm-hmm.
It was a wonderful era, and it's beautiful visually, and it really helps with the repressed sexuality and those themes, but it's not particularly about America in many ways.
Right.
Yeah.
The setting and the Civil War was just a vehicle for this story. Mm-hmm. The story wasn't dependent on the era necessarily or the setting at all. You know, that just was the means of getting this connection between these people.
Yeah, exactly that.
I like that. And it shows you that it's a good story because I really was engaged. It's not just a historical document. You know, that's not its only draw. It's not even a big draw of the film, in my opinion.
No, not at all.
This is a side note, but it kind of goes into this. I just read through a substantial chapter in George R. R. Martin's Dream Songs. And he's basically sharing his ideas alongside his stories. And he's got a term for this, and it's called furniture rule, the furniture rule. And so this Civil War setting is just the furniture for the human story. It's like the furniture, the chairs, the things that they sit on. Maybe they use a revolver. Maybe they use a blaster gun. It's all just window dressing and furniture for a human story.
That is a good way to articulate that. Yeah, that's exactly what I think. Yeah.
That's really good.
Well, thanks, George R. R. Martin.
Well, kind of similar to previous film that we talked about, like episode 17, 16, was It Comes at Night, and how they just kind of use the horror genre to act as a vehicle or act as a furniture. I mean, I don't want to bring that.
Let's not bring that film up.
We'll be at each other again. But yeah, just kind of like... I think exactly like the furniture idea is great because you can change everything just by dress and setting, but it can be the same story because you could make that in modern Iraq or something like that. You could make it in Vietnam. It doesn't have to be a war. It could just be someone, you know, fleeing something else in life and just finding themselves in the same kind of situation. You can remove, reverse like gender and sexes. And like,
I was going to say, how different would this film be though if it was one woman with a bunch of guys?
People would die.
The men are ugly.
Well, and then kind of getting into spoiler territory for anyone. I mean, we kind of talked about in some generalities, but let's talk about more so toward the ending, because I was a little torn with the ending because I found it to be kind of abrupt and everything like that. And I'd be curious to gauge what everyone else's thoughts were. So just you've been warned. This is where we're going to get into much deeper spoilers on how the film wraps up. So I would like to hear your take, Neil, and then Kyle.
Well, first, you started off, man.
Well, fine.
What was your thoughts on the ending? You brought it up.
I thought anytime a movie doesn't give you what you want, it's kind of a good movie in that respect, because it's not playing toward convention at all. Because they could have... I mean, Neil, you were there, and I was like, oh, he's going to get back up. Like, wait for it. Like, the mushrooms that they poisoned him with... wasn't enough, and he's going to be either in the bottom of the basement wailing in sorrow, and these women have to just listen to him like slowly die, or he's going to wake up and it's about to get slasher film level, which honestly the Beguiled trailer kind of sells it as going to be a slasher or thriller at the very least. But he just died, and they sewed him up in a gunny sack and put him outside front for the troops to carry away, and there you go.
I kind of liked it how it ended.
But yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. It's like, I liked, like, after kind of realizing I didn't get what I want, sometimes that's a good thing, and I think this film is the example of that.
I think it, like, the moment he died, so basically just, so, well, I'm hoping people have already seen it, if they've, you know, listening to this, but essentially what happens is he kind of takes over the house after he gets his leg amputated from a horrible stair fall.
A calamity, if you will.
A calamity. They have to amputate his leg, and he is livid, and he basically takes over the house. Instead of being prisoner, he kind of he runs the show a little bit.
Right.
Turns the tables.
Yeah, exactly. He turns it on Nicole Kidman, basically. Mm-hmm. And in order to get rid of him and to save the family or the boarding school, she poisons him during dinner with some poison mushrooms. And so he does. And they put him in a little bag and put him outside for the Confederates to pick him up. And that's the ending.
Yep.
So that's basically how the movie ends. This all being while Kirsten Dunst's character does fall in, like,
yeah,
they basically are together, at least in her mind. Mm-hmm. We don't know exactly what's going through his mind, but she finds her soulmate, basically, and she thinks they're going to run away together or something, and the next day, he's dead, and they're sewing him up, and he's gone, and I just thought the ending was, like, an interesting way of, like, how quickly back to civility, like, this little microcosm got to.
Yeah.
Like, while she's, like, depressed and sad, she, like, goes along with it, and it was just, like, this pipe dream that took them out.
Her dream was gone.
Yeah, I don't know.
It's just everything the returns.
The abrupt ending of it, and everything is back to normal. you know.
It was very kind of, it was a very true to life ending, for sure. And I also kind of want to, I guess we can, Kyle, I'm curious about your perspective. And then I want to talk about the leg being amputated and the symbolism with that. But what did you think about the ending of the movie?
I was, like yourself, taken aback, I think. I didn't think it was anticlimactic or abrupt in a sense, because I really felt that tension in the dinner scene with the bowl of mushrooms there. It felt like the building blocks of just this great story, like classic Greek tragedy, you know, like somebody poisoning another. There's poison there on the table. You don't know if somebody who's not supposed to eat it is going to eat it. And so I was so enthralled with that scene, and I did not think he was going to get up. But it's kind of like, it's kind of depressing in a way that it had to go like that. Like, I sat there and wondered about some of the possibilities, and because it, like, the style of the film and the way they tell it is so austere, I really didn't know who was being sincere. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, between Dunst and Farrell, between this older teacher and the soldier, you know, what their desires really were at that point. He apologizes pretty much at dinner, and it's like maybe there's this possibility of him living peacefully with them for a moment. And then the mushrooms. It felt very tragic to me.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he kind of reminded me of a... Because that's like sort of the 101 for abuse by anybody is, I'm going to beat you, and then I'm going to say sorry to you, and I'm going to beat you again. So I feel like he was an unchanged character.
I mean, what? But
in
like,
some respects, but
I never thought about that way before.
He wasn't the villain.
I don't think he was the villain. I mean, he certainly wasn't a good guy either.
We really don't know that. I don't know.
Like, honestly, it's like he lied to Kirsten Dunst, then started banging another girl, got caught, got pushed down the stairs. They saved his life by amputating his leg. He was pissed by that. Threatened to kill all of them, and then after he got full level of control, and the one girl who would give him the last out of a ticket, which was Kirsten Dunst, because she was so naive with her romanticism, he still took advantage of that, had sex with her, and then is like, sorry guys, like, remember when I shot the chandelier off the ceiling? Woo! That was a time. That was a moment, and it just like I just felt like he was still a bad guy at the very end. He was only nice and kind because he was satiated and had an out.
But that's still like, I don't know, like, we don't know what he's seen in war. Like, this is not like a normal peacetime. Like, The dude has probably murdered so many people / seen horrific things in life that he's just not even, I don't know. Like, yeah. There's just something different about it to me that...
Well, and even if you take all of that aside, like take the whole war and everything aside, the dude probably hasn't seen a woman in how long. He's away from his home. He shows up at this house full of beautiful women. And yeah, instead of dying
on the battlefield.
Yeah, instead of dying, and he flirts with all of them. It's not as if you might look at him as a con man, but honestly, he might just be playing the field.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that makes him a bad guy, because at least several of them are flirting back. And then it's this act of violence, which, to get into your symbolism, not your symbolism, Cooper, but the pretty clear symbolism of the film is this idea of castration.
Which, right, that's what I wanted to get into.
Yeah, just flips him. And it's like, I was in his head, not only being a guy, but just imagining waking up without your leg.
I don't feel like I feel like I'd be like, what happened? But I think it was because he's screaming at him at one point. He says, look at me. I'm not even a man anymore. And I thought that was very interesting to have that kind of, with the castration of his leg. And now the women are in control, and how he doesn't like that lack of control. And his goal then is to get control anywhere, anyhow, any way that he can do it. And he becomes a prisoner in his room and they lock him up. And the women now have all the control, whereas for the other 8/10 of the film, Colin Farrell had pretty much free operation.
No, he wasn't in control still. I mean, he was playing the game to survive, and he, you know,
yeah,
he had some good moves, but he wasn't in control until the end.
Mm-hmm. And then it's not as if he like, so he's using these kind of political manipulative flirting methods in the beginning. But to your point, Cooper, when he starts screaming that he's not a man, there's only one way that he knows how to try to take back control. And it's through violence. He's not going to try to reason with them at this point. Even though he did kind of reason in order to and manipulate to get the gun. But yeah, I don't know if I can cast judgment on any of them as being particularly good or bad.
Right.
Like even the little girl gets the mushrooms to kill him.
Yep.
Knowing that they're going to kill this man.
Yeah, I never thought for a second that she was bad. If anything, she was like the best, you know, like the most pure character.
Yeah, they just kind of made her complicit in it because, yeah, I felt probably worse for her because she didn't want to kill Colin Farrell and she was just following the madam's orders.
A little side trivia. I don't know if it's Webster's or whoever does the word of the year, but complicit was one of the most searched words this year.
Yeah, I remember that.
It makes sense.
Yeah, interesting time. But yeah, and it's very interesting. And I was curious of one thing. I honestly didn't look it up, but it's just pure speculation on my point. But in Southern tradition, if a male, especially a young buck, single, you know, stayed the night, you would sew them up in a gunny sack so they couldn't sexually participate with another person.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Like if you stayed the night, they would sew you up in a sack, you know, head exposed still. And but it's still the head poking out or whatever, but you're sewn up and you can't do jack diddly until they like unsew you. So I was curious.
That's amazing.
I was curious if
that's
that
so
was
forward of what they assume your intentions are.
Yeah. They're just like, listen, we're just going to be safe and put you in a sack. It's like, can't you just lock a door? Yeah, we'll put you in a locked door, but you still going to be in that sack, boy. Yeah, and they used to just like put people in sacks, and I thought that was kind of interesting and reminiscent of putting him finally in a gunny sack, just like how they would a young buck, but no head exposed at all. And I was curious if that had any kind of symbolism to the time, to where it was just like your level of sexual threat and your level of threat is completely gone. Like it's encased. And I think that's a very, it's like not to like gender kind of stereotype anything, but I feel like encasement is more of a female's kind of perspective, to where it's like, if you look at male ideas of like killing, it's through penetration, it's through death, it's through some kind of damage from the outward to inward. Whereas like more so methodologies of women killing is like obviously with poison, obviously with like encasement or like, you know, using any kind of threat that's passive to do it. So I thought like kind of an encasement into a womb, that a man being placed back into a womb, being placed into a form of not being able to move or anything like that after being castrated as well. I wasn't sure if that was a continual role of symbolism in the film or not. That's pure speculation on my end, but I wasn't sure what you guys thought about that.
I think that sounds totally reasonable. And the symbolism at this point is ours to make of it what we will. We're the audience. The text is out there. We've just got to read it as best we can. And I love that this film, like, we keep talking about how it's so austere and at times subtle. It doesn't lay any of this on super thick. You know, you could watch it as a total literal deal. But here we are able to pull all of this imagery out of the southern landscape and vegetation and then what they do to his body at the end. It seems so simple, but it's deceptively simple.
And I think that's something that you get when you have control, because Sofia Coppola was talking about, because people were like, hey, like, you know, you're getting more and more big time as things come on, like, what if someone asks you to make the next Marvel film, Infinity War Part 2? And she's like, yeah, no, I really like having full directorial control, even with these small budget kind of films, because Beguiled was only $10 million and took place in one location. So pretty small potatoes, like, compared to the blockbusters that we're now more accustomed. But she does, what she gets to do with it is so much more, and she gets to stretch that dollar and really put her influence on, especially in, you know, an industry that is definitely known to quash, like, female directors and do all that kind of no good net kind of things. Because it was Nicole Kidman was actually talking about how she loved working with Sofia Coppola because she gets to have, like, this wonderful female perspective that is very absent within both television and within films. And she quoted that in 5,000 TV episodes, 475 of them were directed by women. And so it's, like, a terribly small percentage where, like...
And wait, in 5,000 episodes of...
Television. It's, like, general, like, American television. Not quite sure about the sample population. I didn't get to see the study or anything like that.
Okay, yeah.
Because that could be hand-picked, because you just could just pick all the male ones. So I assume it's fair, but it was something like some abysmal number of were directed by women.
And I'm honestly surprised it's that high.
Yeah, it's something like within films, they quoted about like 4% of women direct films.
Yeah, exactly. So I was thinking it would be almost closer to that. It's, yeah. When you think of like a female director, Sofia Coppola is probably the biggest.
Catherine Bigelow, I'd say now, after Wonder Woman, is now kind of the, like, Catherine
There's
Bigelow.
Only a few staple names, though.
Oh, yeah, it's like two. It's like, give me five notable female directors.
Exactly.
You can't. Like, I honestly can't do that. Like, my lens isn't directed toward that, you know, that kind of small population, if it was, I'm sure. But in general, it was still great to have, like, a female's perspective with this kind of specific film, with The Beguiled. But, I mean, overall, like, I would highly recommend it. I guess this is where we go through the Anderson scale now. Yeah.
Oh.
So, briefly, if you haven't heard of the Anderson scale, let's have Neil give a little quick synopsis on what the Anderson scale is.
Are we going to... maybe we should have a segment. We should pre-record a segment.
Yeah.
That I give an explanation so we can just cut to it. So it's just
that'd be good.
Same every time. It's kind of like we have a little music segment. The Anderson scale. We have to pronounce it right.
The Anderson scale.
Is just a bell curve scale. Like whenever you're talking with your friends and you're like, hey, on a scale of 1 to 10, what did you give this movie? And someone's like, oh, that was a 7. What they really mean when they say that was, yeah, that was okay. Mm-hmm. That was barely passing 7. If they said 6, they would say, eh, not very good.
Right.
So I don't like that because it super dilutes all the other ratings where, like, okay, so you only have like 2, like, or 8, 9, and 10 that are like good movies and everything else is like, I think we can all see. Yeah, obviously right. It just dilutes the rating. So my rating, the Anderson scale, is a bell curve. Well, 5 is most movies you've ever seen. The average film is a 5.
It's passable.
It's just like, that's just most movies are 5s. And so every standard deviation above and below a 6 or 4 is a standard deviation above or below the average movie. So if I said, oh, this movie's a 6, I'm saying, yeah, this was a good film. I recommend it. I definitely recommend it. There you go.
And there you go. That's the Anderson scale.
There's no such thing as a 10. Because if you found a 10, it probably changed your life and you found God or something amazing. And likewise, it's almost impossible to have a 0.
Yeah. That's the pursuit of all filmmaking, is to get to the 10. It's impossible to get to it, but the pursuit is
strive for perfection.
Yeah. Forever driving. Kyle, so what would you, following the Anderson scale, we haven't heard from you in a hot second, what would you rate The Beguiled?
It's a really good question. I don't know how long it'll really stick with me. I think all of it is exceptionally well made, to where I'm tempted to give it a 7, but I just don't know if it's going to live with me to the point, because I've rated some other films that I just love a 7. So I don't know. It's tough for me. I'm somewhere between a 6 and a 7 right now. Totally recommend it. Mm-hmm. But I'm just being a little
to our viewers, a 6 is
solid.
Solid film.
It's a solid film.
Yeah. So don't think that means it's bad.
Yeah.
If we can, I'll go with a 6.5 for now.
I think that's where I'm leaning on as well.
Same.
I was going to say a 6.5. I think, and you said it well, of I'm not sure how long it would stick with me. Shot incredibly well. They did some interesting things with a low budget. Acting is great. But it's not a life-changing film for me.
Yeah, I would say that a good way to put it is I'd buy it and keep it on my shelf as an example of an excellent movie, but it's not something that I'm going to watch year after year. For me, like, it's something for the archives 100%, but just not something that I would want to watch over and over again. I do probably want to watch it one more time. I'd honestly like to see the 1971 take, by Don Spiegel.
Siegel,
right? Siegel. Don Siegel.
Guy
who made Dirty Harry, if you don't know who that is. Yeah, I'd like to check that out and see how the differences within both the takes are. But yeah, so I would definitely give it a 6.5, 100%. And then just to kind of clue everyone else in and to kind of remind everyone how our new scheduling is going to be working, that you're listening to this hopefully Friday, 8 a.m. as soon as I put it out, that we're going to be having new episodes for the first 3 weeks of every single month. It's going to be most likely a modern film for the first week. The second week, we're going to have something a little bit shorter, more hot takes, some simple recommendations. That's going to be 25, 30 minutes. And then we're going to do a historical film that really adds to cinema, where we'll do very thorough deep dives and thorough research to see what that film added to the pantheon of cinema. And the fourth week, we'll take the day off. So just know that every single Friday for the first 3 weeks of every month at 8 a.m., there's going to be a new episode, and we're happy to be a part of that day. So just so you can kind of mark that on your calendars, just keep that in mind.
Mark it
right now. So next week, expect us to just talk about some generalities. Sometimes we might even be exploring critical essays. So if you have any films that you'd like us to do any kind of severe critique of, to maybe hear just one of us, like Kyle or Neil or myself, discuss a film in depth on a custom level, feel free to comment below. Let us know if that's something that'd be interesting to you. I actually had one person reach out to us via email that I was going to tell you guys about here in a little bit. But, you know, like always, guys, thanks for watching. Always appreciate it. Listen to our previous episode, Blade Runner with 2049. Neil and I dig into some deep dive information there, discussing about
sentience. I like how that's like the... the coined term now.
Deep dive?
Deep dive.
Deep dive. The Deep Dive Podcast.
That should just be our tagline.
The Deep Dive. Actually, be a good name for a podcast, honestly. We can rename ourselves.
The Deep Dive. Jot that down.
But yeah, so in closing, guys, just want to always say thank you. If you're listening to this on iTunes, give a comment. You know, feel free to share this on Facebook or the Twitter. You can follow us at on Instagram at CinepilePod, where we just post good information about cinema in general, some cool screenshots, and also shows when we're going to be posting the most up-to-date episodes. So if you want to know when new episodes are coming out, you can follow us on there, again, CinepilePod. And again, thank you for listening. Appreciate you if you've been here since episode 1, and we also appreciate you if this is the first time listening. And like always, I've been Cooper Carr.
Neil Anderson.
And Kyle Montgomery.
And check out The Beguiled. Bye, guys.
See you
on the next one.
Bye. Thank y'all.